John Darnton knew his father only as a mythical figure, a New York Times correspondent who'd been killed in action during World War II when John was only 11 months old. John would go on to follow in Barney's professional footsteps, working for the New York Times and winning a Pulitzer and two George Polk Awards during his 40-year tenure at the paper. In his new memoir, Almost a Family, Mr. Darnton applies his keen investigative skills to his own family's history to learn more about the family he thought he knew and the father he never did. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
What kind of impression had you gotten from your mother about your father?
That's interesting. You know, there was I think in the life of every child who loses a parent or isn't raised by a parent, there's a kind of a vacuum. And our imaginations as children hate vacuums. And my mother quite, either consciously or unconsciously, filled it with tidbits of information and a kind of silhouette of a man who was larger than life. He was a hero. He had laid down his life for his country by volunteering to go off to cover the war as a correspondent. He had fought in World War I as a young man just out of high school in Michigan. He was said to be a man of great wit. Debonair was the word she used over and over to describe him. So he became this kind of mythic figure.
And it's understandable that she didn't tell you the complete story.
Yes, it is. I think that's true.
I mean, you don't say your father cheated on me and all sorts of things like that.
Right, right. Well, that's true, and that's also a product of the times. This was in the 1930s, early 40s, and it was time when there were a lot of newspapers in New York, and many of the newspaper men and women, mostly men, lived a kind of semi-bohemian life down in Greenwich Village and, you know, fraternized with writers and adopted the kind of mores. We think sex began in the 60s. I guess it was Philip Larkin who said, it really began in 1932, probably.
Well, your mother also worked for the Times.
She did. She was hired after his death in 1942 as a reporter in the Washington Bureau. And then a year after that, came up to be the first woman's editor in New York.
So how old were you when you started learning the real story about your parents' relationship? Hmm.
I would say I was quite old.
You mean your 20s or 30s?
I would hear things from time to time.
Well, like what, that they were never married.
All right. That emerged in 1968, shortly before our mother's death. I have an older brother, Bob, who's 2.5 years older. And when she was suffering from cancer at one point, we all needed money, and we suggested that she apply for his Social Security. And she said, well, I can't. And we said, why not? We took a long walk on the beach in Cape May Point, where she then was. And she said, well, we were never married. And that came as a great shock to us because, of course, part of the myth, and in a way my book is about myths, part of the myth was they had this kind of unshakable universal love that overcame all sorts of obstacles.
Do you think that she didn't see him as good husband material, or were there just
no,
other circumstances?
I think it was a practical matter because I then did some research and found some documents. Each of them was married to someone else when they first met. And they decided, each of them, to get divorced. But I think it was very messy. You know, in those days, it was very hard to get divorced in New York State. You had to prove adultery. And you even had to go through the charade of finding usually the man in bed with another woman who would
bring
be
in a
hired.
Photographer and burst
yep.
into the hotel
they
room.
They did that, literally, on both sides. And in any case, I did some research and documents and discovered that the dates were such that by the time my father was freed with his divorce, she was already very pregnant with my brother, my older brother. So it just, I think they didn't like the idea of going to a justice of the peace somewhere with a large belly.
She brought you up as a single mother, two sons,
mm-hmm.
And she had an alcohol problem.
How did she?
How did she manage it all?
Well, not very well, I guess, is the short answer to that. Part of her notion, and I'm not sure where this came from, was that after his death, she would continue very much as before. That is, we would be raised in the country which in those days was Westport, Connecticut. We'd have an ideal childhood, go ice skating in the winter, swimming on the beach in the summer and be free. And she would be both mother and father, both nurturer and provider. And almost as if we could continue, as if, you know, his death didn't change absolutely everything. This was a lot of pressure, clearly, on her.
And but she became a journalist. She wound up in Washington, so you couldn't do any of that.
No, she did become a journalist, but she ran up against the powers at the New York Times when she was woman's editor. And I uncovered a lot of memos and internal kind of house documents in which she is arguing for a different kind of coverage of women's affairs. And the then managing editor, a fellow named Edwin L. James, would write these little notes in the margin, like, she's talking about sociology, exclamation point. They would have none of it. So she had an unhappy experience there, and she left to establish something called Women's National News Service, news about women, by women, and for women.
So she was an early feminist.
She was, and maybe too early, because it didn't work, and it drained. She took a lot of the money that had been part of the settlement of my father's death and put it into this news service, and which ultimately failed in 1954. And so her drinking went along with that, I think.
Your brother is a historian.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to enlist his help when you were researching?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. My brother, Bob, had the idea of doing a book himself. This was in the early 80s.
You could have collaborated.
He asked me to. Oddly enough, then I kind of wasn't interested. I was, working hard at the paper, and there were a lot of questions I just put on the shelf and never considered. And he wanted to do a different kind of book. It would have been a book about journalism in the 30s and 40s. And luckily, he conducted a lot of interviews with contemporaries of our father and mother who were still alive then. And he took notes. And he handed all the notes over to me, including several interviews with our father's second wife, which turned out to be absolutely critical for understanding what those times were like.
You even learned about the way your father was killed, different
yes.
than what your mother had told you.
Well, she knew the basic outlines, but she didn't know much. He was, as a correspondent, he was covering basically what was going to be the first ground action of the war involving the army, that is, in New Guinea. And he, the outfit there was the 32nd Division, the one he had fought with in World War I. They had a wonderful reputation in World War I. The French called them Les Terribles because they were so powerful. They broke through the German lines. This was not to be the case in World War II. In any case, he kind of used this. He exploited that connection with the general and got permission to cover the first ground action. And as they were rounding the coast of New Guinea to prepare for the battle, which later occurred at Buna, a plane flew overhead. And he made a notation in his notebook, plane across course, Jap or our, ? The plane, which was an unidentified bomber, disappeared, then took a big loop and came back from the southeast. Bomb bay doors open, and four bombs were dropped on the ship that he was on and a sister ship nearby. They missed the ships, but a piece of shrapnel struck him in the back of the neck, and he died. It did turn out to be a case of friendly fire. It was an American B-25 based in New Guinea. My mother knew the vague outlines of the story, but she was never wanted to follow it up. And I was able to find the name of the pilot, the name of the aircraft itself.
You even went to the spot, didn't you?
And went to the spot.
And you spoke to an eyewitness.
I did. That spot was always kind of sacred in our family lore because my mother insisted and raised us with this story that she knew of his death the instant it happened. She was in Westport, Connecticut, and there he was on the other side of the earth. And she said she felt something wrong, so much so that she had to go outdoors and sit down and collect herself. And sure enough, the next day, she got a call from the New York Times saying he had died more or less at that time. So I always thought that that part of the world was kind of like there would be a rip in the sky or something. And I went there to Papua New Guinea.
I would have imagined you'd have mixed feelings about the Times based on this past, both your parents working, yeah, your mother's unhappiness, and yet you wound up at the Times for a very long time.
I did, yes, 40 years. I don't think I had a mixed feeling at all. The Times' history and my own is so intertwined, it's sometimes hard to pull it apart. But my father, my mother, my brother, my wife even, and myself, we've all worked for the Times. So I often say it's like, we're West Virginia coal miners who can't get away from the company store.
And you covered Poland during martial law, during a communications blackout, had to smuggle your stories out of the country. You won a number of awards as a result of Pulitzer and George Polk. But did you realize at the time that you were, as the cliche goes, writing history as it actually happened?
I did not, no.
Somebody must be thinking that about this year. Here we are, 2011, so many important things happened. It's only March.
Well, in my mind, there's always been this debate between journalism and history. And I sometimes even engage in that debate with my brother, who's now a very eminent historian at Harvard. He maintains that we know more about the past than the people who were living through it knew at the time. I maintain the opposite. So I do not have a sense that I'm writing for history, but I believe ultimately history will look to what we write to figure out what was going on.
Well, you've also written a novel, Black and White and Dead All Over, based on your years at the Times. I wonder whether that experience helped you in writing this. After all, you'd never had to write anything that went over a couple of thousand words.
Yeah, well, I've written five novels, and it did help me considerably because I discovered I can write every day in 1,000-word segments. I stop as soon as I hit 1,000 words, and that's about the length, or used to be the length of a newspaper column.
Are you still the curator of the George Polk Journalism Awards?
Yes. Yes.
So you won a couple, and then they made you put you in charge?
Yes, they drafted me, right.
They decided they didn't want to give you any more?
I wish that had been the motive, but no. And we've just announced our winners, and we have a very, very good crop this year, and we're about to have our annual luncheon and bestow the prizes on them.
Are you writing any journalism these days?
I'm doing the occasional op-ed piece, but no, basically no.
Do you feel you got out in time? Because journalism seemed, at least the old-fashioned journalism, the kind that you grew up in, the kind that your parents both practiced, is kind of dying, isn't it?
It's over. It's over. And that was the time, I think, the golden age of journalism, especially for foreign correspondents. I mean, you know, they gave me a credit card and said, go off to Africa and kind of let us know when you arrive and start filing stories. That was the greatest possible freedom to have. These days, I'm afraid, reporters go off, they get fitted for flak jackets, they go to survival training, and they cover an awful lot of human misery and suffering with sat phones, so they have to stay with the story day in, day out.
And we expect to see our television anchors in Japan one day and Tripoli the next.
And look at the news.
After they've been to Cairo.
The news is just, one catastrophe and war after another.
John Darnton will be speaking with David Gran at the Strand Bookstore this Thursday at 7 o'clock. That's at Broadway and 12th Street. His memoir, Almost a Family, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much.